I just want to say a couple words about our next speaker before she comes up. You know, when I started to come around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really struggled for a long time to find a strong woman, you know, and there's a real shortage of women in AA, you know. The death rate for women in Alcoholics Anonymous is much higher than the men. There's not a lot of us. So whenever I see a woman, you know, who is in this work and strong, I am so very grateful that they carry this message, you know, to those of us who are still suffering, you know. And Tara's been somebody who has helped me tremendously and been a great part of my journey, and is a tough gal that carries this message, and I'm really, really grateful. From the Jay Walkers group in Freeport, Tara.
Hi everybody, my name's Tara, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, I want to thank the group for inviting me to speak, and I want to thank one of my friends who could probably get up here and tell my story, who's known me for 20 years and knows my story as good as me, and she showed up tonight anyway. Thank you. I actually killed my friends, I didn't see them. My story. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like growing up and a little bit about what not to do in AA. Probably a lot more about what not to do in AA than what to do in AA has been my journey. I did not grow up in an alcoholic home. I did not see alcoholism. I grew up in a very nice home in Massapequa to loving parents who gave me a great life. And you know, I know that there are people in here who didn't come from that type of place, and that's not what makes you an alcoholic. You know, where you come from isn't what makes you an alcoholic. I believe I was born an alcoholic. I believe I was born with this disease. I had this attitude from early on that I just know now today is part of my alcoholism, which was, you know, I had this great life in my home, but at school I didn't have a great life. Kids are cruel, and I was the tallest kid in school. I had no hair on my head, like a baby fuzz that a baby's born with, so I was 8, and I had black teeth, really black teeth, from medication I was given from being very sick as an infant. And every day on the bus I got told, you're ugly, you look like a boy, why don't you brush your teeth? And I would walk through the door at the end of school after being tortured and pushed around and, you know, just totally ridiculed and ostracized, and I'd walk through the door and my mom would say, you know, so how was school today, honey? And I'd say, fine. That's not normal. That, I was in so much pain from such an early age, and I had this attitude of never let anybody see that they can get to you. Just don't let them see that they get to you. I never even cried in the privacy of my room. And this went on for a long time. I never shared it with my family. One day on the bus, or somewhere around fourth grade, it was, you know, the usual, my books being thrown around, whatever, but somebody stuck gum in my head. And all I remember is seeing red, and the next thing I know, I came to, and a couple of kids had, like, bloody noses, and everybody was backed up away from me, like she's crazy, and they never picked on me again. You might think mission accomplished, but I gotta tell you, getting picked on was better than being invisible. It was horrible. I never got invited to a party. I never got invited to play at, you know, the kids' house after school. I was alone on the playground. I thank God for books, because reading and books and music are the two things that gave me any kind of joy, but books was my big escape, and I read every waking moment that I was awake, even with my little flashlight under the covers when I was supposed to be sleeping. I wanted my world to go away, and I just escaped into books. I still love books today. So this continued until I was 12, 7th grade. I was in gym class, size order, no squad, and the most popular girl in school, the cheerleader, the petite one that all the boys loved, played the flute, you know, Miss Popularity, turned around to me and said, do you want to come over my house after school? A bunch of kids are coming over and we're going to drink beer and smoke pot. and I say this every time because it's the truth, if she would have said, a couple of us are going to go rob a bank after school, and we need a lookout, you want to be it, I would have been like, I'm there, you know, and I have this, I call it the pick me, choose me, want me, that I still suffer from today, going back from then, you know, pick me, choose me, want me, doesn't matter what it's for, just pick me, choose me, want me, and I will gladly sign up. So I went over this girl's house, not having a clue what I was in for. I mean, I never even saw anybody drunk. Smoking pot, like, hello, what? I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I really didn't care. And I have to say that I really believe that alcohol saved my life. I really believe it. I don't say that to be dramatic. I believe it saved my life because I honestly believe I would have been a teenage suicide if I did not find the relief that came from, I'll never forget that day as long as I live. It was an instantaneous, oh my God, this is what's been missing from my life, my whole life. And my life got so much better from that point on. I mean, it really did. I had friends. I started selling pot. You become very popular when you start selling pot. I'm hanging out with all the cool kids now. I mean, I got a boyfriend. You know, it was like from you look like a boy to having a boyfriend, I was like, I had arrived. You know, when Bill talked about I had arrived, you have no idea. I had arrived. And I was loving my life. And there were consequences right from the get-go. You know, not major ones, but I went from being a straight-A student to being a straight-F student. I mean, that's a pretty, you know, drastic change. I was no longer interested in grades or school. It was let's hang out, and I hung out at like the Sump and the golf course and stuff like that. That's where I did all my drinking. And so anyway, my first boyfriend, I ended up marrying him, and I only say that he was my first boyfriend that I met at 15. I married him when he was 18 and I was 19. And the significance to that little marriage was not the insanity of getting married at that age, because I look at kids that age now and I'm like, it should be illegal to get married to at least 30. You know, I'm like, 18, how could anybody let us do this? Not that everybody in my family didn't try and talk us out of it. But the significance to that is that I caught him cheating on me, not like I imagined it, because I do imagine things, but I caught him cheating on me like a couple of months before this big extravagant wedding. And I married him anyway. And it makes me sad to say that, you know, at 19 and, you know, thinking I had arrived, believing, you know, I had it all going on, my real core belief was that if I didn't marry him, my life was over and there wasn't anybody else that was going to want me. So just suck it up and this is as good as it's going to get. So that's how my marriage started off. And I moved to Long Beach, across the street from two bars, the Digs being one of them. I don't know if anybody knows the Digs, but I love the Digs. And so I started going to bars for the first time in my life because I had been drinking at Sumps, you know, and Forts and the beach and the golf course, the woods. I had never been in a bar. Well, I found the Digs, and it's not any, you know, I didn't go to the pretty clubs, so, you know, there was like Channel 80 and all that stuff going on then, but that was for the beautiful people, thank you very much. I didn't fit in there, I didn't belong there, you would never see me get dressed up and go clubbing. I mean, that just was not me, but throw some sawdust on the floor, put a jukebox in the corner, have it stink, be dark, you know, dirty and dark, and I was like, this is where I belong, and I loved it. And what I discovered at the Digs at 4 o'clock in the morning was that a lot of guys thought that you were attractive and wanted to get to know you better, and it was like, and what the hell did I marry this idiot for, you know? So, needless to say, I proceeded to destroy that marriage because now I found the bar life, and I took off and running with that. And you know, as a woman, alcoholic, I started to cross a lot of my own personal lines that I had set up for myself. You know, I would never do that. You know, things I would judge other people for, I would never do that. All of a sudden, I'm doing it and justifying it and then drawing another line in the sand and crossing that one. And as a woman, there was a lot of shame attached to a lot of the things that I did. In public, as a married woman, alcoholism brought me to a place of being an unfaithful wife, very much in the public eye in a very small Peyton Place town. I'm not proud of that. So anyway, that marriage ended, and boy, was I thinking I was having the time of my life, because now there was nobody to watch me, nobody could control me. I had my own apartment in Long Beach, and I knew when it was ladies' night all over the island, every night of the week I drank for free. And as far as I was concerned, as long as I was hitting that train and getting to work in the morning, 3 days out of 5 of the week, I was good. You know, it was, I would miss, you know, Mondays, but then it started being Fridays and Mondays, you know, and I took advantage and of a job and got paid for hours that I just wasn't there and wasn't responsible. You know, these are just results of my alcoholism. I used to get on the train to go to work. They had smoking cars back then. I would just sit there and smoke on the train, get high on the train, you know, go out for liquid lunch, come back bombed, stumble off the train. I mean, I don't know when I crossed whatever line it was, but I do know it went from a point where it was something that I decided to do, like I want to go out and have fun, to it no longer became a choice. And it stopped being fun. And That's when it started getting a little scary, you know, because I was saying, I'm not going to do this tonight, and I would end up doing it, you know, and I started losing control over what I was doing, and it got pretty crazy. I couldn't do the most simplest things without having something in me, you know. It got to the point, like, forget about the supermarket. Like, I think somebody else said a story about the supermarket. But, like, I go to the supermarket because I needed food, and, like, the lights were too bright, and there were too many people, and I'm just like, I would abandon my cart, you know? Like, all right, tried it, you know? Who needs food, you know? It would just be like little things like that, you know, were, like, overwhelming to me. And I knew it was kind of getting a little crazy when I had a drink to go across the street to drink. Like, just to get out of the house, to go across the street to drink, I had a drink, you know. So it stopped being fun, and I started getting suicidal. It really wasn't fun. I tried to convince myself I was having fun, but it wasn't. And I was praying to a God I really didn't think I believed in every night. Just please don't let me wake up tomorrow. You know, just please just let this be over. Like, I was okay with that. I was really okay with that. And, you know, I don't know if anybody else had this feeling of waking up in the morning, opening your eyes, and just being like, oh, my God, I have to do this again. Like, it was just the worst feeling in the world. Like, it was just too hard. Life was just too hard. So I was in another bar in Long Beach, the Sandbar, and feeling very hopeless and very dramatic and very life sucks and you guys are all a bunch of idiots. And, you know, some guy just happened to pull up the bar stool next to me, and I filled him in on my tales of woe, and he said, oh, no, it doesn't. I'm going to prove to you different. Life can be great. Well, I married him 6 months later. And, you know, here we go again. But luckily, he ended up in a rehab. And this was my sober dates, August 24th, 1986. So back then, I didn't know anybody who went into rehab. I didn't know about rehabs. I didn't know about AA. I didn't know anything about any of this stuff. But he went to a rehab in Minnesota. And I was 3 months pregnant at the time. And I went out there for family week to learn about alcoholism and how I could be a supportive wife and, you know, help him with his problem. Because clearly he had a problem. And they recommended that I go to Al-Anon, and I came home and I went to Al-Anon meetings, and I wasn't getting it. You know, I wasn't really identifying. So I like to say that, you know, people say you really have to want this to get it, and I don't believe you have to want it to get the gift of recovery. I really don't believe a lot of us want it that get it. You know, I believe you have to want it to keep it, but I don't believe we have to want it to get it. And God will use whatever he can use to get us here. And for me, I did not even think I was an alcoholic. I had no clue I had a problem, but my biggest problem then and probably for the rest of my life will always be my insecurity and my jealousy based on just my life experience, you know. And What got me into my first AA meeting was I was going to check out the women who were going to steal my husband away from me. Now, when I told my story for the first 2 or 3 years in AA, it went something like this. And being that I wanted to be a supportive wife, I came to learn more about alcoholism so I could help my husband better. Total lie. But I believed it. It wasn't until I cleared up a little bit that I'm like, I am so full of crap. I came here because I want to check out the women. I was totally threatened because they're going to understand him in a way I possibly can't because I don't know anything about what he's going through. I don't have an alcohol problem. So, needless to say, you know, I would go around the room and we would share and I would, you know, they'd call on me and I'd say, hi, my name's Tara. I'm a concerned person. And they'd all chuckle because in the rehab, that's what you are. You were a concerned person. And I never said I was an alcoholic for a long time. And then I started, like, really liking the meetings. Like, I was hearing people talking about stuff that was in my head. You know, like, people actually were talking about things. And people were talking about actually not drinking. And I saw, you know, people having fun and making friends and doing things. And I liked it. So I asked the group if they would take a group conscious to see if I could come to the closed AA meetings, even though I wasn't an alcoholic like you people. But I really felt better when I came to the meeting. So would it be all right with you if I kind of sat in on the closed meetings? I know it's kind of like a secret society on those days, but would you? And they're like, honey, here's a meeting list. Go to any meeting you want, any day of the week. I'm sure they'll love to have you. I'm like, you're sure it's not? I don't want to be the exception to the rule, you know. I know I don't really belong. And they're like, just come. And that began my journey, you know. And what happened to me, and I think it happens for a lot of us if we're lucky, is one day you hear your story. You hear your story from beginning to end. And I was at a meeting in Oceanside, and this girl, and I was really new, and this girl got up, and she is telling my story, I mean, everything, even the reading the books, like everything. And I called up my husband, and I was like, you got to be kidding me. You told this girl my whole story? I was so angry. I'm like, how dare you? He was like, what are you talking about, you know? And then I got it. I'm like, wait a minute. If she has a problem, I knew she was sick, and she had a problem. I'm like, oh, my God, maybe, like, I really belong here. And that was, like, my aha moment. Like, oh, my God, maybe I really belong here. And trust me, I was delusional for, I can't even tell you how many years in AA. Totally delusional. You know, they don't talk about us being in denial in the big book. They talk about us being delusional. Denial, I kind of know what's going on. I just don't want to look at it. I don't want to own up to it. But I know it's in there somewhere. Delusional, you don't have a clue. And I was clueless for a very, very long time. And I have to say that I absolutely, with all my heart and soul, love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart and soul. You will never hear me bash the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. You know, they kept saying, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. My self-esteem was so low. I mean, I remember when I came into a meeting and somebody said, hi, Tara, the fact that they remembered my name, that I wasn't invisible, that when I share something and 2 days later I see somebody in the meeting, how'd that work out with your mom? Like, people paid attention. When people said, how you doing today, they actually hung around to listen. You know? I was like, what a concept, you know? It really, the people, and I have friends that I have been friends with for over 20 years. Lifelong friends. But you'll never hear me bash Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you're trying to survive, if you're an alcoholic like I am, and you're trying to survive on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't come in here and alcohol does not bring you to your knees, I pray that your alcoholism does. To get you to the point where you're desperate to work the program of recovery that's outlined and not just find friends. I so needed you. I so needed the friends. I so needed a family. I needed you people to love me and care about me. But what I learned in the big book is that we're beyond human aid. And I was putting all my faith in you. And guess what? You're all humans. Every one of you. I'm beyond human aid. I don't care how many of you are in the room, unless you're an alien or something. I mean, you know, collectively, you're still a bunch of humans, you know? And I found out that I was really beyond human aid, you know? I really got that. Like, when I truly got like how sick I was. And I can tell you that my life was a train wreck in AA. This is my journey. You told me to get a sponsor, I got a sponsor. You told me to go to meetings every day, I went to meetings every day. You told me to get a commitment, I got a commitment. You told me I had to sponsor people, well, that was kind of scary, but I was sponsoring people. You know, I was doing the best I can. I was loving on people the way people loved on me. You know, I was giving you all the love I had to give, but I was not giving you the cure for alcoholism. I did all those things. I went on retreats. I went on international conventions. I mean, I went on Sober Club Meds. I managed a sober nightclub. I mean, I was throwing myself in AA like you can't imagine, and I wasn't doing AA. I did everything but AA. And what happened is I became suicidal doing all that. Doing all that. First time I became suicidal, my friends pretty much scooped me up, took me to doctor, and he's like, hey, you need medication. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I didn't need medication. I needed a program of recovery, you know. The second time I became suicidal, it was really, really bad. And it was really bad. I'll never forget it. I had a newborn baby, and she was probably the only thing that sparked any sort of feeling of love in my heart at that time. I was so far removed. I was so sick of my alcoholism and so far removed from anything good at that point. And my plan was we had a tiled bathroom with a glass shower door, and I was going to kill myself in the bathroom because it would be easy to clean up. No mess. Just shoot myself in the bathroom, go down the drain, wash it down. My daughter would have a new mom within 2 weeks. I was convinced of that because, remember, the jealous insecure part did not go away. And, you know, then this thought dawned on me, and I know it was God today. There's not a doubt in my mind. This thought came to me that if I used my husband's police revolver to kill myself, it was supposed to be locked up and secured, and he might lose his job, and he wouldn't be able to take care of my daughter, and I couldn't have that. So what did I do? I went to a meeting where I probably sounded like a spiritual giant the day before, mind you. And she had exactly that, only I was, like, switching. And what did you people do? You scooped me up and loved me again. You scooped me up and you loved me, and you kept an eye on me, and you babysat me, and I needed all that love, and I needed all that love, and I needed all that love, but that love was not fixing me. It just wasn't fixing me. I self-destructed in so many areas without picking up a drink in my life. I almost lost my house to foreclosure. I mean, I wasn't paying my electric bill, and my electric was getting shut off, but I was buying a $300 pocketbook and telling you about it. What a deal. My friends were looking at me like I was insane, because I was. I mean, I had a baby at home, and my electricity's getting shut off because I needed something to fill that hole. I had this hole in my soul that I tried to fill with food. I was 100 pounds overweight. I tried to fill with things. If I just get this, it'll be better. If I just get that, it'll be better. If I just get straight A's, I'll be okay. No matter what it was, it wasn't working. And what I've come to learn is that hole I have in my soul is a God-shaped hole, and only God can fill it. There's nothing else out there that can fill that hole. And I would die with that hole if I lived to be 110 if I did not fill it up with God. So I continued that insanity and suffering from untreated alcoholism, still involved, for 19 years. At year 17, was a pretty major turning point in my life. I had been married for 20 years to that man who went away to rehab. He was 17 years sober. I was 17 years sober. Had a 9-year-old daughter at the time. And I got to say, we went through a lot of rocky times, the two of us in our relationship. It was, you know, you put one alcoholic, put another one together. If you don't have God in the middle, good luck. That's all I got to say. Good luck to you. Don't even bother saying I do if he ain't in the middle, as far as I'm concerned. You don't stand a chance in hell. So, and everything I say, by the way, is my opinion. It's not the opinion of AA. I don't even represent this group or my home group. It's my opinion. So let me just pressure set that at the beginning. But anyway, we had gotten to a point, I don't know how, but we had gotten to a point where things were really gelling for the two of us after going through a really rocky point. You know, he had just gotten promoted to detective. I had just gone back to school and got my teaching license and was really enjoying that. We decided to renovate our home because our home looked like it was a disaster because it reflected our marriage. There was no caring in our marriage, and our home reflected that. So we made a commitment to each other. We were in this for the long haul. doesn't happen too often anymore. So anyway, I was at work, back to school night, an inner city school, trying to give back to the community, loving life, and he went swimming during a hurricane and drowned. So like that, everything was very different. And the significance to that story isn't even that I didn't drink for me, because God just protected me so much. You know, when I was in the emergency room on the floor, like in this fetal position with this guttural moaning coming out of me, I never felt closer to God in my life. It's like I was in the most pain I was ever in, and I just felt God holding me. And I heard it. You're going to be okay, Tara. You're going to get through this. You know, AA, I'm going to be here for you. AA is going to be here for you. You're going to be all right. And I believed it. But the significance of the story is really, to me, that you don't have to go through anything alone in AA. Nothing. You know, when I first got sober and they said, you don't have to go through anything alone in AA, I was like, well, yeah, whatever. I'm alone. I'm a loner. I do everything alone. I don't depend on anybody, God forbid. You depend on anybody, because if you have expectations, you got to be disappointed. You know, that was how I came in here. And thank you. But what happened was, you know, I remember sharing when I was newly sober that I had to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles. And how do you do that sober? I mean, back in the day, no, you don't understand. For all you young people here who get to go take a number and sit on a bench and be comfortable and go out and have a cigarette and come back in and check your number, it wasn't like that 29. You waited on a line for 3 hours. You got up to the window and they said, sorry, you should be on that line. Okay? So there was no way I was doing this sober. There was just no way. I mean, let's just pack it in right now. And I remember these two women, like, that I didn't even know, said, honey, you know, like, we're not working today. We'll go to motor vehicles with you. And I was like, who are these people? But they went, and I stayed sober. And the significance of that is that, you know, I've always had a sponsor in my life. I had a sponsor for pretty close to 20 years. And I had women in my life that are like family. And what was significant about going through that experience for me was I couldn't go to the bar without having a drink. I couldn't go food shopping without having a drink. I couldn't get on the train to go to work without having a drink. But yet I had to go find my 9-year-old daughter and tell her that her dad died without a drink. And not only did I not have to do that alone, but what's really significant about not doing that particular thing alone was that my sponsor was with me, who my daughter called Jamma, because she grew up knowing this woman her whole life, and her Aunt Beans was there. And those two women loved us enough to bear witness to that pain, to sit there and bear witness to that. Those are the kind of relationships you get in here. I don't know of too many people who could do that. So let's just say I went a little bit off the deep end. I didn't drink, you know. I was just out of my mind. And you don't know you're out of your mind until you come out the other side. So it was very painful for the people in my life to witness. I think my biggest regret of my life, I'm 49 years old. I haven't drank in 20-something years. And my biggest regret of my life is not being there for my daughter after her dad died. I ran. I mean, I ran to meetings. I ran to meetings constantly, but I ran. I ran away from her because her pain and my pain were too much. And if I could do anything over in my life, that would be it. I'd be a different mom for her. I've made amends to her so many times that she's like, Mom, you got to forgive yourself because I've already forgiven you. Like, you need to get over this. I don't know, you know, they say we won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. I regret that so much. So much. She lost two parents for a couple of years. And so, you know how the God will use, like, whatever to get you to where you need to be? Well, he used this experience in a big way for me because I had not been alone since I was 15. I went from one marriage, the day my divorce papers came, 3 days later I married my second husband, I was married for 20, I had never been alone since I was 15, and I needed to, like, fill that hole and, like, get a family, and I was on a mission. Boy, was I on a mission. So meanwhile, it's like, you know, now you got to start dating. Well, I wouldn't wish that on anybody ever. Like, oh God. I did not, it was not fun. I didn't like it, but I was still on a mission. And it was horrible. I mean, I had a broken picker, you know. If I picked you, it was doomed to, I mean, it just, I was not in my right mind. It was like, you know, and my good friend used to pray, God, please remove this man from her life. And I thought, there she is. And I got, and I'd be like, hey, Mia, what do you think of him? And she'd be like, going, oh, God. She got two sentences out of him, and she'd be like, oh, you know, the woman's twitching. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, isn't life grand? Anybody who cared about me at that time, oh, my God, I can only imagine, you know, I can only imagine the pain, you know, of watching me and experiencing what my daughter went through during that. But it brought me to a really good place because I ended up in a relationship with somebody who I cared about very much, and I still care about very much today. He's a good guy. The only thing about this relationship was that he was he smoked crack a lot. I don't know how else to say it. I'm like, well, that's a nice way to say this, you know? Well, that's, you know, well, that's what it was. He's a really nice guy, and I really mean that. I mean, I love him to death. I still love him to death. And this relationship saved my life, because what ended up happening was I went from a woman who never had alcohol in her house for all these years, you know. My daughter was never around anybody drinking her whole life, to now I have somebody cooking crack in my bedroom, smoking crack in my car. My daughter's like, what's wrong with him? And this is 19 years sober. I say that term very loosely. And so what ended up happening was he said something to me that saved my life. And he said to me, you know, Ta, I would never want you to lose your sobriety. But every once in a while, I think what it would be like if we got high together. And every hair on my body stood up. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to die. And I was this close. I had met a woman at a Fellowship of the Spirit conference. She lived in Virginia. And I knew I was going to die. I called my friend, my best friend, Michelle, in Texas. And I'm like, I told her where. She had listened to the drama of everything, you know. And she's like, you need to call her now. Get on the house phone. Well, I'm on the cell phone. Call her now and say you need help. Call her now. Call her now. And I called this woman and I said, I need help. I'm going to die. And I told her my predicament. And her response to me was, well, have you ever gone through the Big Book? And I'm like, oh, I've been to plenty of Big Book meetings. Yeah, I go to Big Book meetings. I didn't know what she was talking about. So I was like, yeah, you know. So she goes, no, have you ever, like, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book? I'm like, I'm sure I have over the past 19 years. I've gotten through the first 164 pages one way or another. You know, like, I didn't get it. And she goes, Tara, she goes, we need to do this work together. And I'm like, do this work together. And this woman, I'll be forever grateful, from Virginia, she had me call her every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning at 6 o'clock in the morning before she started her day, her busy, busy day. She got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and read to me for an hour until we got through that book. And we didn't study it. You know, I did a Big Book experience meeting here. I said, this is not a study. I'm not here to study the book. I want to experience the book. Because you can know every single word in there. You can quote a chapter and verse, and you can go out that door and drink. Because until you've experienced what that book has to offer, it's just a book, you know. And I will be forever grateful to this woman. I had an experience. I truly understood that I was mentally ill. Oh, my God. And that was not fun. I knew I was crazy before. You know, okay, I'm a little nuts, you know, make some bad choices, some really bad choices sometimes. But I got, like, oh, my God, I am mentally different than normal people. You know, I am mentally different. And when I got that I was really beyond human aid, because I kept thinking, if I find the right therapist, they'll fix me. If I find the right sponsor, she'll fix me. Like, it was always if I found this right person. If I find the right church, you know, I was going around, all right, this church would work for a while, and then, all right, I'll go to this church for a while. Like, I had to find the perfect thing, the perfect person, and there is no perfect person. You know, the way I like to look at Beyond Human Aid, very simply because I'm a visual person, is, you know, if you're a parent or if you have a niece or nephew and, you know, you're crossing the highway with this little kid that you love more than anything in the world and a bus is coming, man, you are throwing that kid out of the way and you are throwing yourself under the bus for that kid without thinking about it. Instinct. Love that kid. Would die for that kid. Die for that kid. But when that same kid says, Mommy, please don't drink tonight. Mommy, please don't show up at school drunk. Mommy, please don't embarrass me tonight. The alcohol wins. If that human power cannot keep somebody sober, I don't believe that there's a human power that can. You know? So when I got that, it was like, oh, wow. All right. I got to find this power. Now, I had believed in God at this point. You know? I had believed in God. I had come a long way in my spiritual journey, but you can believe in God, but not trust God. And that's where I was at. I believed in the existence of God, but I didn't trust God with much of anything, you know? But when I got to this point, when I realized that I had this physical allergy, I knew if I picked up, I was gone. And I'm going to tell my quick little story about the physical allergy that I got, like, immediately. This is so funny. I used to go to this place with my sponsor, who had 13 years at the time when I was newly sober, and her friend, and we went to this place, the Left Bank, and got a Left Bank salad. And the three of us would show up and get this salad. Now, it was a terrific salad. It had peanuts and raisins and cheese and lettuce. What else is in there, Mia? Apples. And it came with this honey mustard dressing that they would drizzle. Yeah, a little drizzle on top of the salad. So the three of us went and ordered this, and we were like, this is the best damn salad I've ever had in my life. Well, now we were getting our own individual salad dressing on the side. And then by, I don't know, 2 weeks into it, we were getting our own gravy boat pitchers each of honey mustard dressing on the side. And when they wouldn't go out to lunch with me, I was getting it to go with six things of honey mustard dressing on the side. Miriam shows up at the table, blows the whole deal, and says, you guys know, like, that's made with beer, right? And I was like, you can't. That did not click until I went through the work with this woman and she talked about the physical allergy, that our body is different and it actually craves it. I was pouring that salad dressing, taking a few bites. Oop, there's room for more. Pouring some more. Oop, there's room for more. I mean, gravy boats. Can you imagine three women sitting there with gravy boats of dressing? Physical allergy. I got it. Get it. I didn't even know there was beer in there, but my body knew there was beer in there. My body said, give me more of that dressing. I'm surprised I wasn't drinking it straight up. I probably would have gotten there because I believe in the progression of this disease as well. You know, forget the mouthwash and the Listerine. Go for the Left Bank salad dressing. It's really tasty. So I got that part when we went through the book. And that mental, oh my God. A sick mind can't heal a sick mind. Okay, so I can't fix myself and not one human being can fix me. Oh my God. That was the worst, most devastating bit of news. If you don't feel horrible when you find that out about yourself, you haven't found it out about yourself. Trust me. Because it's just devastating. It's like, oh my God, oh my God. Oh my God, exactly. You know? So then I had to find this power greater than myself. So what I thought was the worst relationship was really not. You know, God knew just what I needed to get me to my knees, to be willing to do anything. Because when I called this woman Val, I literally said, I will do anything you tell me to, or I know I'm going to die. I'll do anything. I'll do anything you say. And we got to the third step. And that third step decision, I believe, hands down, is the most important decision I have ever made, will ever make, continue to make. It's everything. It's everything. My, like, relationship with God up until that point was like, I would give God pieces of my life, you know? When I really played all my cards out, like when they were going to take my house away, I became willing to say, God, can you help me with my finances? I'll go to DA. Okay. You know, like, when, you know, that it would have to be, like, everything I let go of had claw marks on it. You know, it was like, I would give God the peace that I could not manage after all everything I tried failed. And it used to feel like, okay, I'm going to trust God with this little piece, you know, and it would feel like, I say, it's like jumping out of an airplane and hoping that when I pull the ripcord, the parachute God is going to open up and do what I think he should do. That was where I was at up until then, you know. This, turning my whole life, my whole will over to the care of God, felt like, I'll never forget when I did it, I'm on the phone with her in Virginia. I'm in a ball on the floor. It's not. I can barely get the words out because I got it. It was all of me. All of me. I no longer have a say. And that felt like jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. It was like, okay, I'll never forget it. It's like, here I come, God. I know you're going to catch me. And I no longer have a say in my life because every time I try and run my life, I'm a train wreck. Every time. Every time I try and run my life, my best thinking, and I'm a pretty, you know, I'm pretty smart. There's a part in somewhere where it says we're like sure that our intelligence backed by our willpower can rightly control our lives. I was like, I'm smart and I am so willful and I can do this. I know I can. And I never could. You know, I'd be beaten up and bloody and then I go, all right, God, I'll give you this little piece. But this was something entirely different. Turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And it's like it was like a commitment I made because it says, think well before taking this step. Right. Think well. Let me tell you, think well because your life will never be the same. It's no longer yours. It's not about you. We come in here. It's all about us, selfish and self-centered and all that. But it says we will bear witness. We will bear witness. God, if you can restore me to sanity, I am going to let everybody know that this isn't about me. I didn't do anything right except surrender. And turn to that power. And I will bear witness. And I will spend every day telling anybody who wants to hear and even people who don't want to hear. My license plate says, let them. I have civilians asking me every day, what does that mean? I get to talk about God and the power of God in my life. But if I let him run my life, it's amazing. And if I try and run my life, it's a train wreck. It's as simple as that. So how do you know if you took the third step? She told me, get a piece of paper right now, pick up a pen, and we're going to start writing. How people say, what step are you on? Oh, I'm in my third step. I don't get that. How are you in your third step? You know? What I came to understand was I just turned my life, my will, everything over to this power. And there was a whole bunch of crap standing in between me and that power. Well, if I want that power to run my life, I don't want anything between me and that power. I want a clear pipe, man. I don't want it blocked up with 40-something years of crap. So I was excited about doing the fourth step. I was like, bring it on, let me know, let me see. And the funny thing about the fourth step is I thought it was about getting to know me better. And I got to see some things clearly, but it was really about getting to know God better. It really was. And it was an awesome experience. When I got to the fifth step, if this woman would have said to me, okay, Tara, I want you to put on your most comfortable sneakers and start walking to Virginia so you can do your fifth step. I would have been out shopping for the best, most comfortable sneakers, probably, knowing me. They would have been very special sneakers. But you bet your ass I would have been walking to Virginia because I was that willing. I swear, I could take a lie detector test right now. I would have walked my ass to Virginia. I really wanted this so bad. Thank God, you know. I finally got to that point. And I spent the weekend with her and God was just there, shining the light on what I had written and just making me more aware through her of things about myself that even with everything on the paper I didn't see until she invited God in. You know, she invited God in and God was there with us. It was wonderful. And then she told me to go upstairs, you know, to her room, to her son's room, and the instructions say, you know, we go and we sit for an hour and we review what we did. And, the last 10 minutes of that hour saved my life because my experience with that was, see now, I really believed that this wasn't going to work for me. I have to say, I was hoping it would, but I really didn't believe it would. So my attitude was, and when we started this together, I said, I'm going to cross every T and dot every I, and if this don't work, I'm going to every AA meeting with that book in my hand and saying, this is full of shit. I did everything word for word. So when she said go up for an hour, I went up for an hour, and I looked at the clock on her son's nightstand, and I was like, okay. Because I wasn't going to be an hour and 1 minute. I wasn't going to be 59 minutes. It's an hour. I'm doing an hour. This woman, oh, I'm telling you, God spoke through her that day. Because, of course, she knew all about this relationship. She knew what brought me to my knees. She knew what brought me to Virginia. She knew. And she turned to me and she said, now, honey, I just want to say something to you. I know that there's one thing that you might not be willing to let go of, which was that relationship. And I'm going, here we go. And she's like, that's okay if you don't want to. I'm going to love you anyway. I'm here to love you and support you, and this is your journey. And if you don't want to let go of that, that's okay with me. I just want you to know that before you go upstairs. And I was like, yes, yes, I'm free to go back and do what I want to do. I just got permission, got the stamp of approval. Then she says, but I just want you to, and I'm like, here it comes. She goes, just see what it says over here, that there's something that you're not willing to let go of, to pray for the willingness. So just keep that, tuck that in your hat, you know, when you go upstairs. I'm like, I'm off the hook, I'm off the hook. So I go upstairs, I look at the clock, I'm reviewing, I'm this, I'm doing everything it says to do, I'm good to go, I'm thorough, I'm honest, no rock left unturned, and I look at the clock, and I got 10 minutes left to go. 10 minutes left to go. What the hell am I going to do for 10 minutes? And just like God said to me, you use that gun, he might lose his job. God said to me, through this woman, pray for the willingness. I got on my knees. I talked to God, and I said, God, I'm not willing to let go of this. He's the one. And I really cared about him, and he really is a good guy. You know, my daughter loved him. You know I don't want to let go of this. You know I want him to get sober. If he would just get sober, I'd have a happy life, you know? If he would just get sober, I know everything would be great. And I But God, if you're telling me that I have to let go of this to be close to you and to be of maximum service to you and those about me, I am willing. I'm willing. And what happened in that 10 minutes saved my life, because when my husband died, I didn't have any of his voicemails saved on my phone, so I didn't have his voice on anything. Now, this guy I knew was going to die, pretty much, someday, probably soon. So when he left me like a cute little voicemail, I saved it so that when he died, I'd have the voicemails. But when I got on my knees and I said this prayer to God to help me to be willing, I grabbed the phone off the nightstand and, hey baby, erase. Hey Ta, erase. I didn't even have to listen to them one more time for drama's sake. It was gone. God removed it from my heart. Not the caring for this person, but the need to have this person fill that hole. God had already filled that space because I was willing. I believe that 10 minutes saved my life, because if I was not willing to do that, I would have come home and I would have smoked crack, because I wouldn't have been willing to turn my whole life and my whole will and everything, my finances, my relationship, my daughter, my job, everything. It's everything. And I was willing because of what she said, because of what the book said. Every word in that book is so divinely inspired. You put it all together, it's like it says exactly what you need to hear to get you to where you need to be free. You know, and I made my list of all persons harmed, came willing to make amends to them all. You know, it says in the book, we made the list when we did our four step. I want to say, I wish that was my only list for my four step, because there were a lot of people I had no resentment against whatsoever that I stole from, I cheated on. You know, they didn't make my resentment list, but I still owed them an amends. I wasn't pissed off at my bosses that let me get away with working 3 days a week, but I still owe them an amends for the time I robbed from them. So I wish it could have just been my four-step list, but that was a starting point. It was a good starting point. All right, so making direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do something with them would injure them or others. I'm going to tell you two of my favorite stories with amends. One was an amends that was made to me, and one was an amends that I did not make. See, I thought making an amends was that I was going to get free. I'm going to feel better because I'm going to tell you I'm sorry. Now I can hold my head up high, and I'm good to go. That's not it at all. You know, we make amends to people so that we set them free. And I actually had my first amends made to me before I even knew what the hell was going on. I got sober in August, and it was January, and I was going to a sober dance. And, you know, I told that my first husband cheated on me, and I caught him, so we know who it is. And I used to pray to a God that I really didn't believe in, please don't ever let this woman be on the road crossing the street because I will mow her down. I blamed her for the destruction of my marriage. I blamed her for everything. I had hatred running through my veins for this girl for years after my marriage was over. And I used to say, if I see her on the street, I'm going to jail. It's done. I'm just mowing her down. That's how much I hated her. So I walk into this nightclub, August, September, October, November, 5 months sober, 5 months sober. And this beautiful woman comes up to me, and she's like, oh, my God, Tara, I can't believe it's you. I'm like, who is this person? And she said, you're my last amends. I never thought I'd get to make amends to you. And I'm like, who are you? And she said her name, and I realized who she was. And she just looked at me with all the sincerity and said, I am so sorry for hurting you. I am so sorry for what I did. She was 2 years younger than me, and she was already sober 5 years. She got sober as a teenager, and she's still sober today. And she hugged me. Now, I had to leave because I was a little freaked out. But in that, but I will tell you, in the moment of that hug, in the moment of her sincere amends, and in that hug, all that hatred I had been walking around with was gone. See, I don't know what she got out of it, but she set me free because I was walking around with hatred in my heart. And it was gone because she made amends to me. Turns out I ran into her at an international convention years later, and I actually ended up sponsoring that woman. So I went from wanting to kill her to sponsoring her. That's one of my favorite amends stories. Yeah, my most recent amends story is one that I didn't make, and I need to share this because it's about setting other people free. And I have an Aunt Roseanne, who I love very much, and she never had children, and I was like the daughter she never had. And I was very close to her, and I hurt her very badly. And she retaliated, and I couldn't get over what she did to me. So she ended up dying. Now, this is a woman I could have walked to her house to make an amends. That's how close she lived to me. So it wasn't a matter of tracking her down, getting on a plane, no obstacles. She was right there. Knew how to do it. Knew she was getting sick, but didn't do it. Didn't do it. She didn't show up at my husband's funeral, and I didn't forgive her for that. She ended up dying. She was very wealthy, and I got cut out of the will. My brother didn't get cut out of the will. My cousins didn't get cut out of the will. I'm the only one who got cut out of the will. Talking a lot of money. My first response was, oh, shit, I knew I should. If I would have made the amends to her, I would have gotten the money. I'm not going to lie. First thought that popped into my head when I found out I was cut out was, That was almost immediately replaced. I'm not talking I had to go pray on it. I didn't have to meditate on it. I didn't have to call my sponsor and talk about it intuitively. No. That thought was immediately replaced by, oh my God, how much I must have hurt that woman to put her in that position to do that. And I never set her free the way I've been set free. How selfish. That I didn't set her free before she died. That she had to take that action. How that had to hurt her. You know? So, the other thing about amends is a lot of times there's amends, and I heard somebody here at a meeting, and they gave a couple of great examples about amends that you think that you know. Like, you know that part, I don't mind so much making the amends. The part I don't like is there anything else that I did to hurt you that I don't know about? That's the part I don't like. Because you never know what the hell's going to happen with that one, right? So, one guy shared, I heard two different stories about that, and I haven't had an experience about that, but these two stories really opened up my eyes to the importance of saying that to people, the importance to saying that. One guy had worked at a gas station. He just left his job, didn't call in, didn't go back, just went off partying, left his job at the gas station, and years later, he's sober. Many years later, he's sober. He drives by the gas station. He sees the son, you know, one of the owners, and he goes up and he's like, hey, you probably don't remember me. I used to work for you back in the day when I was a kid. He goes, oh, I remember you. You didn't show up for work one Sunday. He's like, yeah, man, you know, I'm an alcoholic, whatever, you know, like that. He goes, yeah, I'm really sorry about that. You know, he's like, is there anything else I did to her? He's like, what you don't know is that that Sunday was my daughter's first Holy Communion. And because you didn't show up, I had to show up. And I didn't get to be there for my daughter's first Holy Communion. So who else do we harm that we don't know? You know, who else do we harm that we don't know? Sometimes it's not even about just the harm that we did to that one person. We harm other people. But the beautiful thing about recovery is our recovery spreads in the same way. You know, just like alcoholism, I think it just spreads and spreads and spreads. And it touches so many people. So does our recovery, and that's a beautiful thing. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I love that it tells me to watch, because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. You know, I am so thankful that I was not rendered white as snow when I went to God and asked Him to remove my shortcomings. I am so thankful for that, because there's not a person in here who would have anything to do with me. I would be useless. Useless. It's my humanness. It's my shortcomings. It's my owning up to when I fail. It's my straying away from God and having to go back to God. It's that draws me closer to people. It's my humanness. You know, it's not that I'm, there's no perfection. Thank God there's no perfection. I don't believe we'd be able to help anybody. Select through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. I love that it's about improving, because as good as my relationship is with God today, the excitement for me is that I can improve it and it can get better. And this isn't as good as it's going to get. It's been an evolving process, and that excites me very much. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. I finally got it. Like, the whole purpose of AA is to help people have a spiritual awakening. That's why we're here, you know. And I've been in meetings where, you don't want to talk about God too much. You might scare the newcomer out. Well, if you get that God is your only solution and we're not talking about them, there's something wrong, you know. And like I said, I would never bash other meetings. They saved my life. But I like when it says in How It Works, we beg of you. We beg of you. These are strong words that these first 100 are using. We beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. You know, from the very start. I have had such joy in bringing other women through that book and having an experience all over again and seeing lives transformed, and being a part of that is such a privilege. Such a privilege. You know, I was so on fire after I had my experience, and I was going through with a lot of women, and it ended up getting a little overwhelming, so we all got together at my dining room table, and we were doing it as a group, and we started, we went through it twice, and I was like, all right, enough of this already. And then we came here, actually. We all came here. And from that, a group was started, and there's a big book experience group that goes on Monday nights from just what started in at my dining room table, you know. The fellowship you crave will grow up around you. You know, I don't believe in hiding out in solution-based meetings. I think that is so selfish. For me, it's extremely selfish. You know, I said in my third step decision I was going to bear witness. Well, what better place to bear witness than in an AA meeting and talk about the power of God when they're not talking about the power of God? And if people roll their eyes, I don't care. If there's one person that comes up to me and says, what did you do? You know, how did you get there? It's worth it, you know. So I don't need to be hanging out preaching to the choir. You know, I need to be getting on the battlefield and going out there and standing and saying, I found the solution. You know, I will say to you that if you're new and you're suffering, you don't need to suffer. But my real message is, if you're not new, you're like me, and you're sitting here with double digits, and you're thinking you want to die, you're thinking this doesn't work. You're thinking you're sicker than other people, because I just kept saying I'm sicker than other people. I'm just, why can't I be happy? What's wrong with me? Even when I get what I think is going to make me happy, I'm still not happy. Like, what is wrong with me? If you're one of those people, do it. Just do it.
It works. It truly works. You know, I had so much self-pity when I said, oh my God, if I would have done this 19 years ago, where would my life be today? You know, where would my life be today? And God answers me like that. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. I have more women with time coming up and asking me, can you help me, than newcomers. Going, I want to be free. Because you know what? I still have my challenges. I'm not perfect. Fear can creep in. Insecurity can creep in. I'm still a human being, you know? I'm still a human being. I'm not God. But I'm comfortable in my own skin, and I know where to go when I'm not comfortable. I know what the solution is. Guess what? I'm the problem, and God's the solution, and we're both residing in the same place. How cool is that? I'm walking around with the problem and the solution everywhere I go. You know? And that's basically what it comes down to. But my gratitude is that I know the truth today. I know I'm the problem. I know my mind is not right. I know that only God can restore me to sanity. And then sometimes I need to say, God, restore me to sanity in this moment. In this moment. Because just because I went through this process doesn't mean that I'm sane all the time. I go into, but you know what? The difference is I know when I'm insane today. And I know to say, God, please restore me to sanity. I used to walk around in insanity thinking everybody else, what are you looking at me like that for? What are you so worried about? What the hell is wrong with you? What are you crying about? I got it all going on over here. What is wrong with this girl that she's so worried about me? She's like neurotic. You know? Like today, I get it. That's being restored to sanity. That doesn't always mean I'm sane. The being restored to sanity means that I know when I'm off the beam.
That's right.
And I don't look to go shopping to feel better. I don't look for things. I hit my knees and I say, God, forgive me for straying away from your love and your mercy for even a split second. Forgive me for forgetting how much you love me. We have no clue how much God loves us. We can't even scratch the surface as far as I'm concerned. And one of the most favorite parts of how it works to me, which is totally, totally one of my favorite things, half measures availeth nothing. Because let me tell you right now, if half measures availed me half of what God had in store for me, I would gladly sell for half. Bring it on, half would be good enough. I always say, I came in here with an empty plate. It was empty. And I got crumbs on that plate, and I was good to go. Thanks for the crumbs. I got crumbs. Crumbs were good. God had a whole banquet waiting for me. And I'm going to sit here with the crumbs and go, crumbs are good enough. But God loved me enough to say, half measures are going to get you nothing. Nothing. Because I want you to have it all. I want you to be free. I want you to be out there helping other people. Do you realize that by going through this process and taking this book in your hand, you can save lives? Do you know how powerful that is? There was never a cure for alcoholism before this. Since man has been crushing grapes, since Christ was walking the planet, there has been decimation from alcoholism. Murder and cheating and thievery and craziness and people getting abused. Insanity! From the beginning of time! And with this little book, instead of getting locked up, put away, you can be free. Really free. And instead of decimating lives, you can be out saving lives. We have a responsibility. This is serious stuff. I love to laugh, I love to make friends, but you know what? I have a cure for alcoholism. If you want it. It's good stuff. I beg of you, be fearless, be thorough. Find the God of your understanding. The God of your understanding. Not mine, not anybody else's. Your God, whatever God that is, just find whoever it is and turn your will and your life over to Him. And amazing things are going to happen. Life still happens. You know, life still happens. But I find joy in almost everything, even in the challenges today. It's a shift in perception. I always thought I needed a lobotomy. You know those little tiny eyeglass fixers in the little tubes? You need one of those to just go like that, and everything changes, you know? So thank you for letting me share.